Okay. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. And, yeah, we're going to be talking. It's Triple Play Thursday, by the way. Get your requests in. One artist, three songs. Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Also, another edition of Would Esmeralda Buy That will be coming up. But right now, it's ready for our, it's time for our biweekly visit with Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. He joined us every other week. We missed last week because I was off, so we'll have him on this week, and then we'll have him on a couple of weeks from today as well. Lots and lots of TV to talk about. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, and let's welcome Dan back to the show. Hello, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
All right. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Doing well.
Good, good, good. Okay, couple of pieces that appeared, a couple of interviews that appeared in The Hollywood Reporter regarding Fargo, and I want to discuss that. But let's talk about Fargo, because normally when we talk, it's Thursday morning, and the Wednesday night episode is waiting for me after the show that I watch on Thursday morning. But I happen to be awake, so I watched last night's episode, so I'm all caught up, simply because I would rather watch Fargo than sleep. So,
I would say that, relatively speaking, those are both fine choices, but I honor your preference.
Well, I got to say, is it episode 7? Have you seen the whole? How many episodes are there total?
I don't remember if there are 10 or 13. I think there are only 10, and I've seen as many as you've seen. I'm hoping that I will get next week's episode in the next day or two, so that I can line up an interview for next week's show.
Yeah. I got to say, boy, oh, boy. It was funny when you said that it's only 10. Last night's episode felt, what happened in last night's episode felt to me like it might be 13 after some of the stuff that happened in last night's episode. How do you feel about it in general, all of the 7 episodes so far?
I am feeling better and better about it as it's going along. I think ultimately sort of where I'm going to place it in the Fargo continuum will probably depend on how strongly it closes in these last few episodes. But after the first couple, I was the tiniest bit wary, and that wariness has mostly gone away. I'm still not maybe 1,000% sure about the complexity of the plot and how I feel about how they're going to tie it up in a few more episodes, but the performances, just top to bottom, are so spectacular and such a pleasure to watch that I think maybe top to bottom this might be my favorite Fargo cast. I don't know, because then if you were to pull out the cast list for season 2, I'd go, oh God, of course that's my favorite cast, and then probably if you were to pull out the season 1 cast list, that would be my favorite. So they do a good job casting on Fargo.
They certainly do. And, you know, you mentioned the performances. They're just so superlative. They really are. And of course, the cast is very impressive just in general, but they're doing great work, like really great work. And I think the writing is also just great. I thought last night's episode was really beautifully directed. There were 3 or 4 scenes during it that were, you know, like there's a scene in a library, you know, with a cop and a stranger in the library that was really creepy and beautifully directed. And there's a bus sequence that takes place at the end of the episode, which also was just spectacularly done. Just great stuff in general. And I have to say that the last week's episode, episode 6, it forced my jaw to the floor. Like I don't want to give anything away in case people haven't caught up, but something big happened on episode 6 that I didn't see coming, and I just spent the rest of the episode going, "What?" So,
the show wants you to be constantly reevaluating at all times who the heroes are likely to be, who the villains are likely to be, who you expect to make it all the way through to the end, who you're rooting for to make it all the way through to the end. And I think that's been a case since the first season, and definitely the past couple weeks have been underlining that repeatedly. Noah Hawley said before the season that there was going to be a lower body count than in the second season, which, you know, of course, had a massacre, which will tend to raise your body count rather significantly.
Right.
But definitely, as we head towards the home stretch, pretty much anyone could live to see the finale, and I would be unsurprised if almost anyone ceased to be in dramatic fashion in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. God, it's so good. It is just so good. Let's talk about the interview with Michael Stolberg, because last night's episode, he had some incredible – I mean, he's killing on the show in general, but last night's episode, he has a moment when he comes home from, you know, this – botched up dinner and after this horrible day when his wife is like, you know, trying to take off his jacket and put on his sweater, he has this breakdown moment, which I just thought was amazing. And but what was the interview with Michael Stolberg? How was that?
It was good. He was such a nice guy and such a polite guy. It would almost seem as if he was sort of slipping in and out of Minnesota nice, except that neither of his two characters in the Coen brothers universe have been necessarily all that nice. I mean, his Serious Man character had a lot of different peculiarities and eccentricities and problems, and certainly Cy is somewhere between being a bad guy and being a good guy who's willing to do bad things for what he thinks is right.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of gray area on Fargo, and it's such a good performance. And one of the best things that he talked about in my interview was sort of the origin of the mustache and the hair.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about how there had been a note in an original script that referred to how the character was sort of halfway between a hockey goon and an accountant. And I kind of love that as an explanation for both sides of this character. He was great to chat with, and it's such a good performance. But you could name anyone in the cast, and I don't think I could tell you who's giving a bad performance. So
yeah.
You know, one week I'm astounded by what David Thewlis is doing. One week I'm astounded by what Michael Stuhlbarg is doing. Carrie Coon is beyond a national treasure at this point. Like, I want to give her so many awards and celebrate her so thoroughly. Partially because I'm terrified that Emmy voters might not.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it has to be out there and celebrated in case a horrible mistake is made by the TV Academy, that she has just had this spring that has been unreal as Leftovers heads towards its series finale on Sunday. So,
yeah. Well, I got it. She's amazing. And, you know, you were talking about how, you know, it switches – you know, as you watch it, your reliance kind of switches as to who's supposed to be a good guy, who's supposed to be a bad guy. She's always the good guy. and you root for her in everything she does. I mean, just in little scenes, like her trying to get a form to fill out in order to, you know, to interrogate, you know, the suspect. Just little things like that and how she acts them. Just beautiful stuff. She's just great on the show. Absolutely great.
She's terrific, and the interview that I did for this week's episode was with Olivia Sandoval, who plays Witty Lopez, who has become sort of Carrie Coon's character's sidekick in sort of solving this rash of murders. And they just have such a wonderful dynamic, those two characters together, and kind of putting those two characters as kind of the purest of the heroes in the story. But it still feels more and more with each week as if Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character might be the quote-unquote heroine of the story.
Yeah.
So who knows? And anyone could get to shine by the end, but I think we're going to have a few more casualties before we get to the end, too.
I would agree with that. And I just think, I mean, it's a great piece of television every week. It's great. And now you talked about the director who directed episode 6, correct?
Yes. I talked to Dervla Walsh, who directed 5 and 6.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhat remarkably, in the 3 and now 2/3 seasons of Fargo, she is the first female director on the show, which does not really speak all that well for that particular aspect of how Fargo is approaching things. I think, however, she did a good enough job with the 2 episodes that she directed that I would hope that she will be in Noah Hawley's Rolodex for any and all future Fargo episodes, because she did a terrific job.
Absolutely, no question about it. Well, what other things has she directed?
She won an Emmy about a decade ago for a PBS adaptation of Little Dorrit. She directed a couple episodes of Penny Dreadful, which was obviously a heavily stylized show in which her episodes were terrific. She directed a bunch of episodes of an Amazon show that premiered and kind of vanished about a month ago, and apparently she directed one of the episodes of Netflix's Punisher series, which we aren't going to see for a long, long time because Netflix has many more shows ahead of it. So
right. Yep, got it. See, and we'll talk about this. We're going to take a break. We'll talk about this when we get back. But it just seems Netflix is debuting a show a day.
it's frankly a little bit abusive.
It's crazy, man. It really is. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. We got lots of TV to talk about. He is the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. We always have a blast talking TV with Dan. You can follow him, as always, on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. More TV talk after we take a break for the news. Welcome back, everybody. Hi. Morning, everybody. Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday, one artist, three songs. Get your requests in. You get the bumps, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. That's also our number for talk and text. You can check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. And our Facebook page is the best way to stay connected, facebook.com/Nick D Show. I haven't done it in a while, so we are going to play another round of Wood Esmeralda by that. That's coming up later. But right now it's TV talk with one of our favorite regular guests, Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And we got lots more TV to talk about. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you.
So moving on from, we were discussing Fargo, moving on to what I think is a show that's even better than Fargo. Yeah, and that's The Handmaid's Tale, which... Yeah, no. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, like
there were possibilities. I could have thought of three or four other things that maybe to go to, but that makes sense. I'm with you there.
Yeah, and again, now are you ahead on this one, or are you watching them in real time like we are?
I've been watching week to week, but I have watched this week's episode.
You haven't?
Have?
Oh, you have. So
I am as caught up as we can be.
Okay, so that's episode 8.
Yes.
Okay, good, because we're all caught up then. All right. This show is unbelievable. I'm telling you, Dan, if Elizabeth Moss doesn't win the Emmy, they should just shut down the awards in general.
And I'm telling you, if you were watching Leftovers, this weekend's series finale of Leftovers, Carrie Coon is just right there. But on the other hand, I also am totally on the Elizabeth Moss train and have been since before premiere, so that's going to be a heck of a competition, and I would love to have Carrie Coon actually in the field, and I would love to have Elizabeth Moss in the field so that they can all compete.
Yeah. Well, it's just, how do you feel about the series and how it's progressing, The Handmaid's Tale?
When it's too plotty, I occasionally, I don't want to say tune out because that would be wrong. I occasionally am less invested. When it kind of becomes too much of a thriller, when it starts moving forward too quickly, I don't enjoy it as much. When it's about this world and kind of giving different glimpses into this world, I love it and I think it's fantastic. It's just when it pushes things too fast, sometimes I feel like it becomes a more conventional show, which I'm sure keeps audiences hooked all the more, but I don't need it. I just want to live in this world and be horrified by this world every week, and that's what I find most fulfilling about the show is the weekly dose of, oh my goodness, this is a screwed up world in every way, and they have a very, very unhealthy idea about sex, et cetera. Which was this week's takeaway, in case one hadn't taken it away in the first seven episodes, was they have very strange attitudes towards sex in this horrible dystopian world.
Yeah, it's just, it was a very, very eyes wide shut kind of a thing happening on this week's episode, just adding again to the uneasiness of it. One of the things that that for me, and I don't, I mean, like, I in a sense, I kind of agree with you. When it kind of gets thrillery and a little bit more conventional, it's not quite as interesting. And it on, and for me, the time that I am most profoundly interested in the show is when it's told from Elizabeth Moss's point of view. When they break away and make episodes about other characters, I'm not quite as interested. Although the one-off episode about her husband was really well structured and beautiful. She's barely in that one, really, and it's really about her husband's character. It's about Luke, and I thought that was really beautifully done. And then, you know, they're trying to open it up a little bit more. Like on this last episode, you got to know more about Nick, and in flashback form and things like that. But when it's not really focusing on her, I find myself just getting a little bit like, this isn't quite as incredible as when it's really about this character.
And I think the show has to do things like that, obviously, in order to be a continuing series. I think that if this was just going to be a 10-episode miniseries, we wouldn't have to worry about that as much. But they're trying to make it renewable, and they're trying to make it expansive. And I get that completely. I thought the episode focusing on her husband worked fairly well. I still struggle to care about the commander, either positively or negatively. I mean, he's just gross and awful, and I don't know that I feel necessarily the nuance for the most part, except that the episode that had a lot of his wife, the episode that had a lot of Yvonne Strahovski's backstory, I thought, that was a great showcase for her.
Absolutely,
because it made her into more than just a, you know, one-off, one-dimensional sort of villain, ice queen kind of thing. But it did a little bit to give me more of that character. I still can't bring myself to care about Nick, and I don't know if the show really wants me to. I can't tell. But these are sort of quibbles, and as long as the camera is on Elizabeth Moss, as long as the camera is on whatever Samira Wiley pops up, she's tremendous. But Elizabeth Moss, really, you know, the more it's on her, and this week spent a lot of time with her.
So it's amazing. If you don't, do have Hulu and you're not watching it, you're really missing out on what is currently my favorite thing on TV. And there's a lot of good stuff on TV. I find it compelling all the time. And really, you know, like the production values on this show, Dan, are beautiful. Everything from the costume design to the locations to the sets, the cinematography, everything about this is top notch. It's a great piece of work.
It really is, and it continues to hold up, which was always one of the questions when we started, was what's going to happen when it has to start spinning its wheels a tiny bit to make it into an ongoing series. And so far, I've been interested and engaged by what it's been doing, even when it becomes slightly conventional.
Yeah, me too. I love it. All right. Speaking of conventional, Twin Peaks.
I figured there was at least a possibility that when you led with the show that I like as much, that it could have been Twin Peaks.
Oh, I love.
I don't know what you thought about that.
It wasn't. It hadn't debuted the last time we spoke. And I've seen all four episodes. Have you seen all four episodes?
I have seen all four episodes, and no more than that. So we're on equal footing here.
All right, I gotta say, and I watched all four episodes like the day they were available. So it was a weird 4 hours, man. I'll tell you that much. I love it. I mean, I don't know what the hell's going on half the time, but I love it, and it's incredible, surrealistic filmmaking and crazy. I was a little bit slightly disappointed with episode four, because episode four, if you can say it was conventional, it was more conventional than the first three episodes, meaning that some of it made sense. And, and it was quirky and funny and all that stuff that you love about Twin Peaks. But there was just this hypnotic thing that was happening in the first three episodes where I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. And half the time I'm like, I have no idea what the hell is happening. But it's pretty astonishing. It's particularly episode three. Episode three was so insane that, in my opinion, it makes Eraserhead look like you've got mail. I was just like, what the hell is going on? And adoring it and just being really hypnotized by, couldn't take my eyes off the screen. And the fourth one was great in that very, you know, the Twin Peaks world is finally sort of, you know, thrust upon us, and we're thrown in it with the quirky characters and the funny stuff. But I hope it gets weird again. I hope it gets incomprehensible soon.
I don't think you need to worry about that. I think that there's enough evidence in the first three episodes that this is David Lynch doing what David Lynch wants to do.
Yep.
It's going to be as weird as he wants it to be. No, definitely the fourth episode is the most quote-unquote conventional of them, and it suffers from a lot of things that, if the first three episodes hadn't been as good as they were, you might have worried about. Like, if that had been the first episode, you would have worried about whether it was as outlandish as you wanted it to be. You would have been worried that it was going to become this very strange kind of cameo parade with one guest star after another.
Right.
It's going, oh, okay, well, there's that person, there's that person, there's that person. But I think coming after the first three, you don't worry about that as much. You go, okay, David Lynch wanted to do a weird little cameo-heavy episode, and I assume episode five will be back in someone's head in a floating head in space, or whatever it wants to be.
I just imagine, you know, like a suburban subscriber to Showtime stumbling upon this, you know what I mean? And just going, oh, what's on Showtime? And then finding episode 3 in the first 10 minutes, I see people just going, I'm canceling my subscription to Showtime. What in God's name is this? And I love that about it. I love that about the show.
I think probably a few people who were not fans of the original series did exactly that with episode 1 and 2 as well. So, but definitely episode 3 is the one where things go full David Lynch.
Oh, like, yeah.
I reviewed it off of the first 2 episodes that I saw at the premiere 2 days before it aired.
Okay.
And my initial read on it was that it was actually surprisingly understandable and cogent, even if it was weird.
Yeah.
But then the second I watched the 3rd episode, I was like, oh, okay, well, that made a lot of my review into a lie. Thanks. Which, you know, I think probably is what David Lynch wants to do as much as anything, is make the show essentially unreviewable. And I think what he wants you to do is go on the ride. And he, you know, made the original two seasons of Twin Peaks when there wasn't the same version of the internet there was. You know, there were news groups and you know, stuff like that. But not the same, and so the sort of weekly recap industry didn't exist, and I don't know that Twin Peaks necessarily suits itself to that, and yet, boy, a lot of my colleagues are having some fun trying to play around with it.
Yeah. Now, is Showtime going to premiere 2 new episodes every week like they've been doing?
No, I believe it's shifting to just 1 per week from here on in. I think that there was sort of an immersion process that they wanted to force on viewers, basically.
That's because the Jim Belushi. Oh my God, the Jim Carrey stand-up show debuts this weekend, right? So that's probably why they're going to one episode per week.
I suspect it is, and you know, I sort of wonder what their level of concern is, because the television ratings for the show have been fairly dismal.
Yeah.
And there are lots and lots of caveats to that. For the first point, Showtime wanted to make very clear that more than half of the audience for the first 2 episodes was streaming and on demanding. So that's the first thing they wanted to make clear. Then they put the next 3 episodes online, and then they aired the next 2 episodes on Memorial Day Sunday,
right?
The ratings fell off a cliff for that. So, like, in terms of literal terrestrial on TV ratings, it's not doing well, and that has no impact on how Showtime is doing the success of this show, but it does have an impact on how it's going to get people watching Showtime in general on Sunday night. Keep watching. I'm dying up here. So,
I gotcha. Okay. Well, listen, hang on, Dan, because I want to hear what you think of I'm Dying Up Here, okay?
Absolutely.
All right, hold on a second. That's Dan Feinberg, everybody, and we talk TV every couple of weeks. He writes for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, F-I-E-N. And we're going to talk more TV right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Hi. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're back here. It's Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. 1 artist, 3 songs, 312-981-7200. Right now, though, we'll get back to our TV conversation. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us every couple of weeks. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back to the show. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
Before the break, we were talking about Twin Peaks on Showtime, and premiering this Sunday night is a show that we've mentioned in passing a little bit in the back. It's called I'm Dying Up Here, and it's about the stand-up scene in L.A. in the 70s, executive produced by Jim Carrey. Melissa Leo is in it, among other people. How many episodes have you seen, Dan?
I have seen 6 episodes, I believe.
Okay.
I think that was what I based my review on. It's tough to keep track between the 6 episodes of this, the 13 episodes of House of Cards, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera.
Right.
The stuff just keeps on coming. But yeah, I liked I'm Dying Up Here. It's one of those very, very serious comedians are all damaged. This is not a comedy. It's a serious show about funny people kind of things. And that's not a genre that necessarily works all that well if you look at kind of the history of people trying to do it. And this is a decent version of it. It's the characters are relatively interesting. It's set in 1973, and the environment is very interesting. So there are a few real figures kind of referenced and in the background of things. Johnny Carson is played by Dylan Baker, which is a little bit strange and unusual and amusing. There are kind of cameos by people impersonating, let's see, there's a Richard Pryor cameo with an actor as Richard Pryor. A lot of the 1970s comedy scene people are at least mentioned in passing, but for the most part, it's not real characters, which is a difference from the book that it's based on, which is just about the 1970s comedy scene in L.A. So Jay Leno, David Letterman, Andy Kaufman, all that. That's not what this is. But it's got good texture to it. It's got, reasonably good production values. The pilot was directed by Jonathan Levine, and subsequent episodes weren't and don't look quite as good, and clearly were not quite as expensive. But it's got some smart things to say about a comedian's life. It's got some very good Los Angeles touches, some very good period touches. I don't think it's going to be for everybody, and certainly the Jim Carrey name drawing people in, I don't know what value Showtime thinks it has, because he's not in the show. He didn't write the show. He's just kind of there as a producer and consultant and stuff. But I think it's a solid show. There are a lot of solid performances. Melissa Leo is good. Clark Duke and Michael Angarano have good parts. A couple comics do good work. Eric Griffin, you might recognize from a lot of sitcoms. He's both funny and good. Andrew Santino, who I used to detest because he was one of the worst parts of the horrible ABC comedy Mixology, he kind of redeems himself here. Ari Grainer, who is an actress who has just had a really hard time finding the sort of the perfect breakout role that she really probably deserved. This is a very good role for her as kind of a female comedian trying to make it in a business that is not, that tries to adjust the voices of female comics to fit certain niches, and she's trying to find her own voice. It's got a lot of good things about it. Whether it holds together remains to be seen. It could fall apart almost at any moment, I think. But it's interesting.
Okay. And Melissa Leo's character is essentially Mitzi Shore, right?
Yes. If you know the scene, there will be some. there will definitely be people who you go, okay, I get that person is supposed to be dot, dot, dot. That person is supposed to be dot, dot, dot. There are a couple network executives who pop up. You go, okay, I understand that person is supposed to be this. But she's good. It's a part that sort of starts off looking broad, and Melissa Leo is definitely capable of playing parts very broad, but it gets a fair amount of nuance as it goes. I think the second and third episodes are probably particularly good to sort of make her character seem like a real person and not just kind of a caricature. Okay. And she's a good actress. So
yeah, she's a great actress.
The right material, she'll make it work.
Yeah, I think she's great. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to watch it when it premieres on, or I've got it on my DVR. I'll have it on my DVR for Sunday night. I want to mention, we got to get to Netflix here. And then after we break for the news, after 3 o'clock, I want to get your impression on the upcoming shows for the fall. You saw a bunch of trailers for, the networks, and I want to get your impressions on that. But Netflix has just gone nuts lately. I'm halfway through Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Are you watching that?
I have not started on that. Like, I could give you sort of the list. I've watched, I think, 3 episodes of Dear White People. I've watched 3 episodes of the new season of Master of None. None yet of Kimmy Schmidt. All of House of Cards, which, when I say things like that, it's just awful. None of Bloodline, but I have watched all of The Keepers. So,
Okay. And it's just there's too much, Dan. As Netflix, are they crazy? What's going? And we didn't even mention F is for Family, which I watched 3 episodes of.
Which I also watched 3 episodes of, and that's a show that I really, really enjoy.
Me too.
No opportunity at all to review. I mean, that is a really good R-rated family animated comedy.
Really funny and really true and great voice work from everybody involved. I think F for Family is a terrific show. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is, consistent every season. It's Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. It's got really funny performances, and I will say this. The addition of Peter Riegert to the cast, I find that to be fantastic. It's so refreshing to see him in the, and he's a regular cast member now on the show, and I think that's great. I don't watch House of Cards. I stopped watching that show a long time ago, so I'm not indebted into that. I have not watched any of Bloodline. I've not watched The Keepers, despite the fact that everybody I know has gone nuts over it.
You should definitely watch The Keepers. It is, as we say, the next Making a Murderer, so yeah. You definitely want to check that out. It's pretty compelling stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll get to it, but man, I mean, I'm not even a TV critic, Dan, and I go to my Netflix account, I'm like, what the hell am I going to watch? I've got 8 million things that I should be watching.
And if I were to tell you how many episodes I have in my on my press site that I need to get to for the upcoming season of Orange is the New Black, for the upcoming Alison Brie wrestling.
Oh, I can't wait. Glow. I'm so excited about that one, Dan, by the way. I'm so excited about that.
That is my weekend, is watching my screeners of Glow. So I'm looking forward to that. But no, it doesn't stop, and it's two or three shows per week at this point. And then Netflix did the really weird thing that confused a lot of people this week by dropping several shows this Tuesday, which was largely a product of Emmy deadlines, because the Emmy deadline was May 31st.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know, you get House of Cards there, and, you know, it will get whatever Emmy nominations it doesn't deserve. it's amazing.
Okay, hang on, Dan. Dan Feinberg is here, and we got to take a break for the news. That's coming up next on WGN. All right. How you doing, everybody? Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower overlooking beautiful Michigan Avenue. It's a Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. You program it, one artist, three songs. You got the bumps, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And what Esmeralda buy that? Coming up a little bit later on as well. But right now, let's get back to our conversation. Our biweekly guest, Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we're talking TV. And welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
Hey, before we jump into the preview of the fall stuff and the trailers that you've seen for the network, I understand that you were on CNN International discussing House of Cards. How was that?
I was. They had me in at some random, fairly late time on Memorial Day evening, so I assumed that it was probably watched by people stranded in airports in Southeast Asia and by tourists. On the treadmill in Europe, I believe. I think that's probably CNN International's biggest audience, and it was a pleasure. They actually read a lot of my review out loud. They felt as if my review was very mean. I tried reassuring them that I actually took out most of the meanest lines in my review, and that I could have been far meaner. I could always be meaner, but you know, they seemed a little skeptical of that. But you know, trust me, I could totally be meaner.
Yeah.
But you know, it was still fun and a strange thing to do on Memorial Day evening.
Yeah, well, that's cool. That's fun that you were on there. Real quick, one of the IndieWire articles that you contributed to. This is an easy one. Now, a lot of the times you cheat, Dan, as we know.
I do indeed, fully acknowledge.
But the question here is, pick the best new opening credits on TV, and that's a no-brainer.
I was surprised that everyone didn't answer the Saul Bass credits for Feud, which was, you know, the only thing I thought of. But there were, let's see, what were their votes for? There were votes for Stranger Things, which I'm fine with the Stranger Things credits.
Yeah, they're fun.
I gave second place to the Young Pope, and I think one person voted Young Pope first, and that's a really good credit sequence.
It is.
You know.
It is, and so is Westworld. Westworld has a great opening credits.
Oh, God, I didn't even think about that. I mean, I would have put that down as a honorable mention, because I agree with you. That was a credit sequence that I found myself sort of hypnotically impressed by, and I didn't think about that. I was, you know.
Yeah.
This one was simple. I did not really give it any consideration.
Yeah,
I knew the correct answer.
Yeah, well, no, it's Feud without question. So, but people can check that out. Okay, so let's get to some of the stuff that you saw trailers for. Let's start with CBS. What were some of the trailers you saw, and what were some of the impressions that you had for the fall season?
CBS has a lot of shows about wealthy white men with insecurities. CNN came to a TCA press tour last summer, and the head of entertainment talked about how the network needed to do better when it came to diversity of programming and casting, and that appears not to have been the case. And sadly, that executive is no longer there anymore because he had health problems and had to step down. So we'll see if the next administration does better, but these trailers do not look that great. Of the trailers they showed, I mean, my favorite of them was the Star Trek Discovery trailer, and that's CBS All Access, not even CBS On Air. And I've heard people who were actually devoted Star Trek fans didn't like the trailer, and I think I probably liked it because I'm only a casual Star Trek fan, and I had really low expectations, and it exceeded those. So I think probably my favorite of the CBS trailers was SWAT, which happens to be the only CBS show that doesn't have a white male lead top lining it. Shamar Moore from Criminal Minds is the star, and it's kind of based on the old TV series that was also a Colin Farrell movie, but I'm pretending that it's not. I'm pretending it's just a new LA cop show from Sean Ryan of The Shield, and since Sean Ryan is running the show, that's what I'm pretending it is, and it actually looked more interesting than I thought it was going to as well. Sort of a lot of lowered expectations made things look better. Like, for example, the CBS Big Bang Theory prequel, Young Sheldon, I had low expectations, so it looked interesting because of that. If I'd had higher expectations, maybe not. But These are only trailers, so I'm looking forward to watching the pilots.
Okay. All right. How about ABC? How's that looking?
Boy, ABC has a lot of stuff, and I don't know that any of it looked all that good. They've got a mid-season show called The Crossing that looks like about a dozen different shows that they did in the post-Lost era. A lot of sort of, you know, heavy mythology, kind of semi-sci-fi shows, things like Invasion and Flash Forward and The Whispers and Resurrection. And, you know, it looks kind of potentially mysterious and interesting, but also even more potentially bad. They've got Jenna Fischer in a comedy, and I would like for Jenna Fischer to do good things. They've got a comedy called The Mayor about a rapper who becomes the mayor of a California town, and it looks potentially decent because ABC does well with single camera comedies. They've got Freddie Highmore in The Good Doctor, which is from David Shore, who did House, and it's about a doctor who is brilliant but also way far on the autistic spectrum, and that, I guess, might be a worthwhile twist. They've got a Shonda Rhimes show that looks a lot like a Shonda Rhimes show called For the People, and I keep consistently forgetting the name of the show because it's not a good name. Of the network shows in general, I don't know that there's anything that I'm like, woohoo, bring it on. So a lot of things I've got tentative interest in.
Okay. What about NBC? You just said that you only tentative interest. What about NBC? Anything there that kind of jumps out at you?
Kind of jumps out. They have a show from Jason Kadams, who was the creative steerer of Friday Night Lights after Peter Berg directed the pilot, and it's kind of basically Glee meets Friday Night Lights, and it's about a high school music department that puts on a production of Spring Awakening, and it has the young actress from Moana, who I think looks like she could be kind of a breakout, and it features Josh Radnor from How I Met Your Mother and Rosie Perez from Rosie Perez related things most recently Search Party. It hasn't been that long since we've seen Rosie Perez, but yeah, so that looks interesting of the NBC shows. I was kind of disappointed with the trailer for the Glenn Howerton, Patton Oswalt comedy, AP Bio, but those are both funny enough people that I'm, you know, I figure it'll probably be better than that. But they had a couple comedy trailers that didn't even make me smile, and that's not a great sign.
No. By the way, speaking of Netflix overload again, I just would like to mention that they also MST3K was there.
I watched a second of it, and I want to so badly.
It's great, Dan. I've watched all 13, and it's great. It's back, and it's the reason, of course, I thought of it was because you mentioned Patton Oswalt. And it's true to the spirit of the show, and they picked phenomenal movies to make fun of. But it's really, they did a great job. If you're a fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000, it's
I am indeed and have been, and boy, just when am I going to find the time?
I know, it's nuts. All right, let's go to Fox real quick. Anything, because they've got some like you mentioned here that Seth MacFarlane, Adam Scott, and Craig Robinson have some shows.
They've got people, and those were not the best of the things that I saw. Amusingly, the show that looked the funniest was the show that stars notorious funny man Dylan McDermott, not to be confused with
Dermot Mulroney.
Funny man Dermot Mulroney.
Yeah, exactly.
But he plays a pilot with a mustache in the mid-season comedy L.A. to Vegas, and that trailer actually made me laugh two or three times because Dylan McDermott was genuinely being funny in it. So I'm. It also has Peter Stormare being crazy. It has several things to speak well to it, but it's not out until mid-season. Fox also has the latest in the never-ending series of superhero shows, The Gifted, which is kind of in the X-Men universe, but they can't call it X-Men The Gifted, which would probably do better ratings. It looks okay. It looks like yet another superhero show, and sometimes I like me some superhero shows, but boy, there are a lot of superhero shows. So,
and that brings us to CW's trailers. Speaking of superheroes,
the CW has a serious military drama called Valor, which looks like it belongs on any other network other than the CW. I'm really confused by that. But the CW does indeed have, yes, a superhero show, Black Lightning, starring Cress Williams from Beverly Hills 90210 and Heart of Dixie. And I kind of love that someone is letting Cress Williams top line a network superhero show. So I can get behind that almost entirely. Mm-hmm. And also they at least promise initially that it's not a part of the Arrow, Flash, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow universe, which would be a real release because I don't need everything to be connected.
Right.
So, and then CW also has a remake of Dynasty, which could be, you know, a remake of Dynasty. It's from Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage of The OC and Gossip Girl. So it could be a guilty fun pleasure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that maybe I got some hopes for some of the CW things, which is strange.
When do they start sending out things for the fall that you'll get to see, like full pilots and stuff?
They have already started, but not shockingly, I haven't had time. But anytime I could make the time, I could watch my CBS and CW pilots. And then I assume probably that the other networks will follow suit relatively soon. And probably each year I do my Take Me to the Pilot series where I do quick impressions on the pilots. And I figure probably I will be starting those end of June, beginning of July.
Okay. All right. Great. Hey, Dan, always a pleasure, my friend, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Dan, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Thanks a lot, Dan, and try to catch up on that Netflix.
never can catch up, but always a pleasure.
Okay. Yeah. All right, Dan, talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
See you later. There you go. Dan Feinberg, everybody. Always a great guest. Follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. All right, we'll take a break on 720 WGN.